So, good afternoon. We are starting our afternoon session with a discussion on IFRS 17. And I give the floor to Roberta.
Actually, just before we start, I'll say a few words today.
Oh, yes. Okay.
I know you thought I was here for revenue, Hans, but yeah. Okay, well, as Hans says, it's insurance this afternoon. So you recall last month you decided on the plan for re-deliberating the exposure draft of amendments to IFRS 17 in light of all of the feedback that you'd considered from the outreach and the comment letters. And you recall at last month's meeting you decided on the topics that should come back to the board table, as well as the topics that did not require any further consideration. And of the topics coming back, you decided that you'd be able to confirm six of the proposals in the exposure draft without any substantive re-deliberation. But the remainder of the topics you decided would require some further analysis and consideration of the feedback that we received. And these topics obviously include the other proposals in the exposure draft, as well as some areas you had previously considered in developing the exposure draft, but for which you decided not to propose any changes to IFRS 17. So today's meeting very much follows the plan that we set last month. And we have three papers for you in addition to our cover notes. So first of all, we've got the six proposed amendments to be finalised. As I said, these are the six topics that you decided last month did not require substantive re-deliberation, and Roberta will take us through those very shortly. And then we have two of the topics that you decided required further analysis and consideration of the feedback. So these are the proposed amendments for insurance acquisition cash flows, for which we're recommending no substantive changes to what was proposed in the exposure draft, and then the proposed amendment for reinsurance contracts, for which we are recommending an extension of what was proposed in the exposure draft. And Vitalina and Laura will guide us through those two papers. We'd just like to add, this is Vitalina's first time presenting to the board at the table, so you know what's expected of you this afternoon. As we said in the cover note, we expect to bring the papers to you on the remaining topics in January and February next year. And these topics include the proposed deferral of the effective date of IFRS 17 by 1 year. We expect to ask you to consider the feedback on this topic towards the end of the re-deliberations, once you've considered the feedback on the other proposed amendments and the other areas that you've decided to consider further. So that was just to set the scene for the three papers this afternoon. And with that, I will hand over to Roberta to take us through the proposals to finalise.
Thank you, Alan. So agenda paper 2A. Discusses the six amendments proposing the exposure of draft that the board tentatively decided could be confirmed in the light of the large amount of support for those amendments from outreach and comment letters. As a general note, some of the proposed amendments discussed in this paper are linked to areas that the board will discuss at future meetings. However, the decision the board will take today for the six proposed amendments do not affect the plan for re-deliberation of the remaining topics that the board agreed last month. So I will introduce each proposed amendment separately, and for each amendment, I will ask whether the board agrees with the staff recommendation. So the first amendment proposing the exposure draft that we recommend finalizing is the scope exclusion for loans. This is discussed in pages from 2 to 6 of the paper. We recommend finalizing the amendment as proposed in the exposure draft, including the proposed transition requirements for entities that will choose to apply IFRS 9 rather than IFRS 17 to those loans, and reflecting a drafting suggestion from one respondent. So question one for the board is set out on page 6 of agenda paper 2A. Does the board agree with the staff recommendations?
We do.
Okay.
Green.
And Fox will say that's
14.
Okay, thank you. So moving to page 7 of the paper, the second amendment proposing the exposure of draft that we recommend finalizing is the clarification that an entity is required to identify coverage unit for insurance contract with direct participation features, considering both insurance coverage and investment related service. So question 2 for the board is set out on page 7 of agenda paper 2A. Does the board agree with the staff recommendation? Okay. And moving to the third amendment, proposing the exposure draft that we recommend finalizing. This is the requirement for an entity to present in the statement of financial position portfolios rather than groups of insurance and reinsurance contracts that are assets separately from those that are liabilities. So question 3 for the board is set out on page 9 of the agenda paper 2A. Does the board agree with the staff recommendation?
Again, that's 14.
And the fourth amendment proposed in the exposure draft that we recommend finalizing is the extension of the applicability of the risk mitigation options to circumstances in which an entity uses reinsurance contract held to mitigate financial risk arising from the insurance contract with direct participation features. So question 4 for the board is set out on page 10 of agenda paper 2A. Does the board agree with the staff recommendation? Fifth amendment proposing the exposure draft that we are recommending finalizing are the transition relief for contract acquired. So we recommend finalizing the transition relief as proposed in the exposure draft, improving the drafting to specify that the transition relief apply to contract acquired in a transfer of insurance contract that do not form a business or in a business combination within the scope of IFRS 3. Question 5 for the board is set out on page 12 of agenda paper 2A. Does the board agree with the staff recommendation?
Not just improving the drafting, though, it's changing, it's extending it, but yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's 14.
And the last amendment proposing the exposure of draft that we recommend finalizing in this paper are the transition relief for the risk mitigation option. As noted in the paper, respondents supported the proposed transition relief, but some respondents asked the board consider allowing a retrospective application of the risk mitigation option in addition or as an alternative to the proposed transition relief. At the future meeting, the board will consider further the feedback on the prohibition of applying the risk mitigation option retrospectively. However, even if the board were to amend IFRS 17 to allow retrospective application of the risk mitigation option, not all entities would be able to apply the risk mitigation option retrospectively. So for some entities, the proposed transition relief will be in any case helpful. This is why we are recommending the board decide whether to finalize those transition relief at this meeting today. So the decision today will not be affected by future board discussion about the possibility of allowing a retrospective application of the risk mitigation option. So the last question for the board, question 6, is set out on page 13 of agenda paper 2A. And does the board agree with the staff recommendation?
Okay.
Hey, Roberta, thank you for a lively discussion.
We needed to do that.
On now to the paper 2B.
Henry. Agenda paper 2B discusses the proposal in the exposure chart relating to insurance acquisition cash flow. The analysis in the paper is structured in five sections, each with a question for the board, and I plan to introduce each section in turn. As mentioned by Henry, overall, for the insurance acquisition cash flows topic, the staff are not recommending any substantive changes to the proposals in the exposure draft. As noted at the end of the paper, there is one aspect of this topic relating to transition, which we plan for you to discuss at a future board meeting. So now I'm turning to the first section of the paper on the allocation of insurance acquisition cash flows, which is set out in paragraphs 9, 17 of the paper 2B. This section discusses the systematic and rational allocation method that the board proposed an entity should apply to allocate insurance acquisition cash flows to the groups of contracts that are yet to be recognized. The staff are recommending the board to finalize the proposed amendment. In particular, we recommend the board does not provide additional guidance on systematic and rational allocation method because we think it could be restrictive and this could disrupt implementation given the concept is used elsewhere in FRS 17. In addition, we think that the proposed requirement does not necessarily add operational complexity. We think requiring a systematic and rational method of allocation allows entities to apply judgment and consider cost and benefit different of different allocation bases. I will now hand over to the board to discuss the allocation method.
Sue?
I agree with the recommendation. I had one suggestion on the point that's discussed in paragraph 14. I felt as though people were sort of asking two things on this, which was one about the systematic and rational method, but I thought underlying their question was really, are we required to update assumptions that have been used when you apply that particular method? And I presume our answer to that is that you are required to update the assumptions underlying that method. And I think it would be helpful to also clarify that in the final amendment.
Jin Chao.
Thank you, Hans. First of all, I support staff's proposal. I think the proposal will better reflect the profitability of the group of insurance contracts and also will better reflect the business model of some insurance companies. I understand that there is two key issues. First, how to determine the expected renewals of the contract, which is based on the expectation, and also how to allocate insurance acquisition cash flows on a systematic and rational basis between the group that's including the original contract and the group that's including the renewals of the contract, both actually involving judgment. I understand that there are some concerns about the arbitrary, judgment or something like that. So I think, of course, based on the systematic and rational basis, add some discipline of those allocation of acquisition cash flow and cash flows. I'm thinking that whether it is possible to add some, additional wording, even either in the standard itself or the basic conclusion, that when an entity, to undertake some judgment, it should be based on evidence or available information such as historical data or business model or something like that, in order to avoid, any arbitrary judgment.
We have words like that in IFRS 17 to do with the estimating of future cash flows. I'm not sure how easy it would be to link the idea of a systematic and rational allocation to those words or not. I mean, I think we felt that by requiring the allocation to be systematic and rational, that gave enough discipline, and we wouldn't want to go further in constraining how people made judgments about doing that allocation. But we could look into whether, to the extent to which the words that support the estimation of future cash flows, whether the ideas behind that could be linked to this allocation.
Mary?
Two points, again, related to this allocation question. First, in respect to paragraph 14, I found Sue's comment very helpful, because reading the paper, going back to paragraph 14 several times, the phrase "results in changes in the amounts allocated to groups" is a phrase I struggled with a bit, and I found Sue's comment about updating the assumptions underlying the method kind of gave me, I think, is a clearer articulation about updating, you know, what the expectations are for updating. And maybe I'll, so I think it's going to be very important how we word any comments that we make about this expectation. And maybe I'll come back to its interaction with the impairment when we get to the later question on impairment. But the other thing I was going to say, it's maybe covered a bit by Jing Zhao's comment and your response. I agree entirely with the staff that we should not start providing guidance at this point in time about how you should do a systematic and rational in terms of methodology, or even if it was examples of acceptable ones. But I did wonder whether we needed to say anything about, it's not just systematic and rational on its own, but the idea is that and I don't know if this is assumed in rational in particular, that the method you chose has to relate to your expectations about how the future cash flows will be generated, both by existing contracts and the expected renewals. You know, it could be perfectly systematic and perfectly rational in terms of a logical person could do it, but is there any requirement to link it to the issue that is the subject of this assumption, or is that something that we just assume is covered by the word rational?
I would say we're not assuming that. We did consider when we were drafting the ED whether we ought to talk about this rational method of allocation, the objective being...
Right. I'm talking about objective, not methodology.
To reflect expected renewals. And we decided when we published the ED not to include that as an objective for the allocation, mm-hmm. Because we thought that we didn't want to make any implications about what we thought systematic and rational meant, given that it's used elsewhere in IFRS 17. So we stepped back from giving an objective to do with mm-hmm. expected renewals. I mean, so I think we would say that clearly, looking at the way that the allocation has to be to do with expected renewals, looking at the way that you expect to recover the asset would be one way of doing a systematic and rational allocation, but we are not precluding there being other ways of doing it.
Daryl?
So I think just on the discussion on systematic and rational, I can understand where the views are coming from. But I just say as a starting point to be really cautious, because if we go into further detail on this one, but not on other uses of the same term, we imply that those are specifically absent in the other applications. Equally, if we try to expand this beyond this particular usage of the term, we have the risk that there are unintended consequences that we get into. For me, systematic and rational implies that you have to have applied judgment, and I think that was the term used. And the fact that there is a review process over financial statements means that you must have documented that in some way, and somebody else must have looked at it and agreed that that was a systematic and rational basis. And I think anything that we do further than that risks either treading on toes on the other, or unintended consequences on the other, or implying, as I say, that the other doesn't have to have the same process or approach.
I spent quite a lot of time thinking about exactly this point that Mary's raising, because I think it's implicit in the whole reason for why we're doing this amendment that our expectation is that the systematic and rational basis, at least ideally, would be thinking about renewals.
Yeah.
But we sort of are where we are with the words. The thing I think that gives me comfort, and I'm hoping the answer to this question is going to be yes, I agree, Sue, is that the way that this then interacts with the impairment test, if you do some weird allocation that's nothing to do with renewals, you're going to come unstuck relatively quickly, I think, with the impairment test, which does focus more closely on renewal expectations. Is that fair?
Yes. I mean, you wouldn't be able to recognise an asset that you couldn't recover because of the impairment test. Yes.
Yes. Can we now agree with the staff's recommendation?
So this is question one.
This is question one.
And can you clarify that point? Was my correction, my observation on paragraph 14 fair?
Yes.
So that's 14.
Right, now I'm turning to the second question of the paper set out in the paragraphs 21-24. This section discusses the unit of account that an entity should apply to recognise an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows. The staff recommend the board confirm that the unit of account for an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows is a group of contracts. We think this is consistent with the level of aggregation requirements in FRS 17. We also know that if an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows was recognized at an entity level, it is highly unlikely that the impairment losses would be identified. I will now hand over to the board for discussion of the unit of account.
Anne?
I agreed with what you're suggesting and asking in question two. I thought it was quite illogical to suggest that it should be at the entity level. It, for me, it just didn't follow through, and I think it would mean that the impairment test was not effective. So I agree.
Also agree, I think, and I'll come back to this point, I'll circle back to this a little bit later because that's important in one of the other points we've raised. Whenever I've talked to people other than preparers about this particular proposal, they see a lot of value in understanding when an impairment happens, because they see that as talking to the judgment that's been exercised, the quality of future expectations and determinants, and etc. And so it seems like if you go to a higher level than group, you lose what is perceived as very valuable information. I think that is a natural thing of us allowing this additional asset to be created, to have the impairment test at a reasonable level.
Can we support the staff's recommendation?
Question two is set out on page 9, please.
Yeah, question two. 14 again.
I'm turning to the third question of the paper, which is about impairment test. This section is split into two parts. Firstly, paragraphs 27-30 discuss the frequency of the impairment test, and the staff remain of the view that the entity should perform an impairment test when there are facts and circumstances that indicate that an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows may be impaired. We know this is consistent with other requirements of FRS 17 and also with IS 36. And secondly, part of the section in paragraph 31-34 discuss application of the impairment test, specifically concerns from some respondents that thought that two-step impairment test is unduly complex. Some respondents suggested that what we describe in the paper as the additional impairment test, and which specifically targets the cash flows for the expected contract renewals, is not needed. However, as explained in the staff analysis and in the Appendix A, both group-level tests and this additional impairment test are required. In the example, in the Appendix A, the impairment loss is identified by both tests. However, we know that there could be scenarios and different circumstances when either test could identify an impairment loss not identified by other tests. Therefore, the staff recommend the board to finalise the proposed amendment. I will now hand over to the board for the discussion of the impairment test.
So I think there are two things that sort of come about because of this two-step approach. I think some people's comments were concerned about whether or not you would ever get an impairment, or whether one test was sufficient to always capture the impairment. And I think the example illustrates very well why, in fact, you do need the two tests in some circumstances. But I said I'd circle back to this a moment ago when I talked, and I think this is the important thing, is that if you speak to a lot of people who are going to be using these financial statements, they also see value in the outcomes of both of those tests. And in particular, the outcome of the renewal test is a very useful one because that's going to be hanging around for longer. So I definitely support where you've landed both for the reason that it does produce a different number and for the reason that that number is useful.
Mary?
When I came to this part of the paper, it caused me to go back and look again at the paragraph 14 that we were looking at before about allocations, because I did begin to wonder in respect to the second test, not having doubts per se about the need to test that separately, so I wasn't kind of saying, do we really need to do it? But I began thinking about the question of what will it catch, particularly if you read paragraph 14 to say you go back and revise amounts that have been allocated to groups that have already been recognized, and even thinking about revising, you know, the amount of CSM recognized. And, you know, from some of the offline discussions I've had with the staff, you've confirmed my understanding that would, you know, you wouldn't be going back and doing kind of QM catch-up type thing. So, you know, when you think about paragraph 14 as maybe updating assumptions, I think it still leaves the possibility that you will have something allocated to a group relating to renewals that needs to be tested separately with the second test year. But I guess I'm offering this comment now that I've kind of sorted out the thinking of the interaction between the two in my own mind to a caution that we've got to be very careful about how we're doing the final drafting on this and maybe thinking about whether there needs to be any commentary that links the two things about the allocation and the second step, the renewals only of the impairment test discussed here, because thinking about how they interact could be challenging at times.
Yes, so I think, Mary, what you say is important, that you're not allowed to change the allocation that you have already made to a group that has been recognised. So when you look at the asset at the reporting date and you're thinking about how should that be allocated to future groups, you're going to revise that using the same method but using up-to-date using up-to-date assumptions mm-hmm. that method requires. You could nonetheless still have an impairment test, because it could be that no way of allocating that across the renewals could be enough to cover the asset that you've got. So, yes, you need to do the allocation looking forward based on current assumptions, but that you also need the impairment test. You do need to do both steps.
And I wasn't really questioning the impairment test, you know, the second of the impairment test. It just was the challenge in thinking through the relationship between these two.
Yeah. Mary, just to be clear, what you're saying is that once you've recognised those cash flows as part of the measurement of an insurance contract, you can't go back to being treated as an insurance acquisition cash flow as a sort of standalone item again.
No, it can't revert back to being a separate asset that you then allocate to future groups, yes.
And it can't get shuffled off to another recognised group?
No.
Okay, are we ready to vote for question?
So this is question three. It's everybody, 14.
Thank you. Now I'm turning to the fourth section of the paper, which is in paragraph 36, 39, and this section discusses the disclosure requirements relating to insurance acquisition cash flows. The staff recommend the board finalise the proposed disclosure requirements, and in particular a disclosure requirement which requires to disclose quantitative information in appropriate time bands about when an entity expects to derecognise an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows. The staff think that this disclosure requirement would provide useful information, and this is also consistent with disclosure requirements in other IFRS standards, for example, in IFRS 15. I will now hand over to the board to discuss the disclosure requirements.
Everybody in agreement? Agreed.
So, 14.
And the fifth section of the paper in paragraphs 41-44 discusses the proposal to present any assets for insurance acquisition cash flows within the current amount of portfolio of insurance contracts issued, which are assets or liabilities. The staff recommend the board finalize the proposed amendment and not require any separate presentation of an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows on the statement of financial position, as suggested by a small number of respondents. This is because the related acquisition cash flows will be included in the measurement of the group of contracts when those groups are recognized, and also the further information about the asset for insurance acquisition cash flows will be disclosed in the disclosure notes to the financial statements. I will now hand over to the board to discuss the presentation of an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows.
Thank you. I agree with your recommendation, but one minor clarification. In the case of some assets that for acquisition cash flows that are recognized for expected renewals, right? Not the current group that was recognized as an asset and liability. So, in the case of the first one, the acquisition cash flow asset, that will be derecognized in the future. So how to present that asset in the balance?
It will be presented within the current amount of the portfolio of insurance contracts which are issued. So it will be within one financial statement line, this asset. But in the disclosure notes, as we are saying,
there is a disclosure note. But what I'm saying is, there will be derecognized in the future.
Yes.
So that if there is some the original group of contracts that was already recognized as a liability, that's kind of a, we can say that's a related portfolio of this acquisition cash flows assets. So are we asking entities to present this kind of assets closely to those related portfolio and separate from those portfolios?
Well, the asset will be will be allocated to, yes, to groups, albeit future groups, and so it will be presented in the portfolio that those future groups will belong to in that line item.
Yes.
Does that answer
your closely question? To that line item, but they are not be deducted from the carrying amount of
It'll be one number, in the statement of financial position. So you'll have the carrying amount of the groups that have been recognised,
yes,
together with the carrying amount of the asset that has been allocated to groups that will be in that portfolio. I mean, this recommendation is completely consistent with the decision you made about presenting things on a portfolio level rather than a group level. So we're just identifying the portfolio that these future groups will belong to, and that's where the carrying amount of the asset will be placed.
Okay.
Did that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense, but just a clarification. I agree with all the principles. The assets will be recognized, that will be included in the carrying amount of the insurance contract if there is some kind of a asset. That was that will be de-recognized in the future, like IFRS 15. So the thing is, I'm wondering is, it's not clear how to present those kind of assets near to related portfolio of insurance companies.
Well, it'll be in that
separately,
line.
Yeah.
No, no, it won't be separate. On the balance sheet, it will be in that line. So the line that will include the groups, that will include this asset once it's derecognized as an asset and put into the measurement of the group of insurance contracts, it's in that line for that portfolio. And it's not shown separately on the face of the balance sheet. It is disclosed separately, but not shown separately on the face of the balance sheet.
So on the balance sheet, then, that cash amount is a kind of a deduction from the portfolio contract liability, right?
Yes, if the portfolio was a liability, this would be a deduction from it.
Sure.
I do agree with this proposed extension of scope that's in question one. I think that it's a rational response from the board in terms of the feedback we got in terms of the amount of help that would really be provided by the relief that we had proposed, given the scope that we had suggested. So I think it's sensible to do it this way. Personally, I would have liked a little bit more discussion from our side of what it was that convinced us or why we decided not to be as concerned about the particular point that we raised in the initial discussion about how could we be confident about the fact that, you know, these were the actual contracts that were being written that were going to be the ones that you were actually going to recover from under the reinsurance contract, because you look at me with
wrong one.
You jumped ahead.
Oh, have I?
Yes. Yes.
We still on five of the previous paper.
Oh, really? Sue, okay, sorry.
You're always ahead of us, Sue. Okay.
Can I see who supports the question number five?
Fourteen.
All right. Laura.
So I'll go to reinsurance.
I was waiting.
Okay, so agenda paper 2C discusses the proposal in the exposure draft relating to reinsurance contracts when losses are recognised on underlying insurance contracts. We received a lot of feedback on this topic. In fact, this was the proposal in the exposure draft that received the most comments. The analysis inside the paper is split into three sections, each which has a question for the board. Similar to the other discussions, I plan to introduce each of those three sections separately for board discussion, but differently to the others, I plan to ask all three questions together at the end of the discussions. So starting with the first part, the first section is in paragraphs 12 to 20 of the paper, and it's about the proposed population of reinsurance contracts to which the amendment would apply. Most respondents expressed the view that the amendment as proposed would apply only to a limited population of contracts, and therefore those respondents suggested that the board extend the scope of the amendment either by extending the definition of proportionate coverage that was proposed or by requiring the amendment to apply to all reinsurance contracts. As you'll see in the paper, the reasons that some reinsurance contracts were excluded from the scope of the proposal apply as much to reinsurance contracts that we know are commonly described in practice as proportional as to other types of reinsurance contracts. And therefore, in response to the feedback, the staff are recommending that the board extend the scope of the amendment to apply to all reinsurance contracts. So I will now hand over to the board to discuss the analysis on the population of reinsurance contracts to which the amendment would apply.
Okay, Sue.
Hi. I had that awful feeling as I looked at Anne's face that I was going to
I didn't
realise quite how wrong it was, but anyway. So now hopefully my comments will make more sense. Won't guarantee they'll make sense. But So, as I said, I agree with the proposal to extend the scope for the reasons that the staff have outlined. The thing that I didn't see much discussion of
in the comments that we got back or in the staff paper was about the fact that one of the things that we had focused on when we went out with the proposals was this idea that if you had, for example, a right to recover only over a certain level of claims and you'd only written a few insurance contracts, how could you really recognise the sort of gain when you weren't probably knew for sure that it wasn't going to be these contracts that were going to give rise to it? So the link wasn't as tight as we had anticipated. I think on balance that's probably a bit of a precious argument in the context of what we're dealing with here in terms of trying to provide practical relief. But I guess I would have at least liked some sort of acknowledgement about that issue and sort of what our thoughts were, which I felt was missing a little bit, but I'm comfortable to support the staff recommendation.
Nick?
I just need some help here because we've gone from a very tightly defined group of reinsurance contracts that this would apply to using our definition of proportional coverage to everything all of a sudden. I guess there is another option of not doing any, but probably realistically it's between those two options, our definition of proportionate coverage or everything. And is it simply that it's very hard to find a line somewhere more granular along the way? Is it really a binary choice?
I think it is probably a binary choice. So I think when the board first looked at these concerns, the board acknowledged that actually this accounting mismatch exists for all reinsurance contracts. But it was the simple examples that had fixed percentage claims that it was possible to identify how much loss recovery there is to go with the loss. And so that, and the board thought it was quite important to give a very specific calculation to come up with that amount. For many examples that are out there, it's actually quite tricky to find out how much of that loss you can recover. The accounting mismatch isn't that easy to identify. So that's why we stuck with this fixed percentage. But then when we were looking at whether, you know, it's expand the definition of proportional or go to all, the reasons really applied to all of those other reinsurance contracts. They didn't have a known fixed percentage. So for us, it was a binary this or everything.
Okay, thank you.
I think it's also what Sue said is absolutely right. And when we looked at the feedback, I think we realised that in focusing on this known link, sort of known through the terms of the contract, that's quite different from what we do throughout IFRS 17, where we look at expected cash flows and expectations and assumptions about expectations. And that it really is the bedrock of IFRS 17. For this aspect, to stick at that sort of narrow, absolutely known link by the contract didn't seem to fit that well within the context of IFRS 17 as a whole. So when Sue was saying maybe it seemed a bit precious to stick at that firm line, I think we felt that, especially given the feedback that we got, that applies only in very few, in practice, in almost no contracts, because there's always something that will knock that link, that direct link out. And so in the context of IFRS 17, you know, if we're going to do this, then doing it on the basis of expectations seems completely consistent with everything else in 17.
Mary?
Certainly the analysis in the section of the paper convinced me that we have to go all or nothing in this regard, for the reasons and that you were just explaining. I think to me, what I'd call the compelling paragraph is paragraph 39. And when you take us back to remember, this is the fundamental accounting model for fulfillment cash flows that we apply throughout the standard. And either we have faith in that model and therefore have faith in the ability, to Sue's precious example, the ability to do estimates with, I'm trying to use the right conceptual framework, wording of with appropriate, to be able to get a faithful representation, I think would be the best characterization, or we don't. And if we do, then that pushes me to all. I am hesitant in taking that bigger step because of the concerns that are kind of discussed, I think, in the second half about should there be any kind of constraints when, in effect, you're increasing an asset that will result in a higher cost in future periods.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that concern is what I think strengthens the argument of the nothing side of the all or nothing. But I think that this analysis shows that trying to take a tentative step for one slice doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I think I do have faith in the fulfillment cash flow approach, and given that, I think I have to, you know, with some hesitation, say it's the all answer in this case.
Yes, because it is true that in doing this calculation, you don't need to estimate any figures other than those you need anyway under IFRS 17.
You're using data that you have to create.
Exactly, yes.
Do the basic accounting.
Yes.
Anne?
This is quite a big change from where we were before. And when we looked at it previously, staff were quite strong on the position this is where we should be looking at these, only recognising the reinsurance contracts that had this direct proportional relationship. And Anne, you've just explained why you can see the factors, but what is it that made you change what was a very strong position, strongly held position before? What is it that's made you change your view now?
Well, as I said, I think it's two things. One is understanding that the population of contracts that we caught by the proposals in the ED was in fact very small. The examples we'd been looking at were, you know, simplistic, idealized examples, and that not many contracts actually are like that. So it was partly the thinking that what we were proposing wasn't going to have the effect that we'd expected, and then also this realization that the IFRS 17 is based on expectations and expected amounts. So to restrict this one aspect to absolutely direct contractual connection didn't fit well. And you know, we could have said, having realized that, you know, that what the ED said wasn't going to affect many contracts, we could have said, oh, well, let's do nothing. We could have done that. But IFRS 17 already includes a similar exception to the basic principles, so adjusting the calculation for the reinsurance contract held for subsequent measurement, and that applies to all reinsurance contracts held. So what we're doing here is bringing the proposal in the ED in line with what is already in IFRS 17 for subsequent measurement. So the proposals in the ED are about initial recognition of the underlying contracts, and we're just making that consistent with what IFRS 17 already says about the subsequent measurement.
Thank you.
Tadeo?
Thank you, Hans. It's much more a practical question. We refer in paragraph 19 that the rationale for open the scope, we could do it without arbitrary assumption or subjective judgment. And then in paragraph 41, we agree that the calculation may not be as simple to apply for insurance contracts held that are outside the original scope of the exposure draft. And then we say that in a certain way, IFRS 17 would already require an entity to have the information for the purpose of the allocation. My question is whether we consult with the insurers whether this is workable and traceable without arbitrary assumptions or subjective judgments. It's just a question whether we can open the scope without adding too much subjectivity, and then, for example, because in the end of the day, we are matching expenses and income. We are allowing some income that would be recognized in the future to be recognized now. What I'm worried with is whether doing that could we have these arbitrary assumptions or subjective judgment?
Well,
workable and traceable.
Setting up the amount that you bring forward to recognise as income, you don't need to have to make any more estimates or judgments than you do to apply IFRS 17 anyway. You have to take the numbers that you have already estimated under IFRS 17 and do a calculation that gives you the amount that you bring of income you bring forward. There's no subjectivity about that calculation. We specify how it should be done. So I don't think it involves any more subjectivity. It does require people to track the thing that we call the loss recovery component, just as they have to track the loss component on the underlying contracts that are onerous. And it is true that, you know, tracking that is, you know, more work than not tracking it. The response that we've had and the feedback that we have had is that this is what people would, this is what preparers would like to do, and they think it gives more useful information, and they are willing to, you know, take on the job of tracking that loss recovery component.
Okay. Martin.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree with staff recommendation, because in the ED we was also concerned about a little bit, because what we are doing here, we booking again against increasing deferred or costs for the future, and that is a little bit odd for accountants to do.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think we felt better in the ED if it is clearly at least calculated without any judgment. You could do that, but really feedback has shown, okay, the population for which that is done is really very small. And then the question is doing it or extending the scope of that. And when thinking about that, when we have already this exception on day two, so subsequent measurement, we have the same issue. When we also book then, not again, but we're booking a kind of then a kind of compensation for the costs which we have on the underlying and for the reinsurance, and also we increasing future CSM, which is future costs then. So it is the same issue. It's only the difference is day one, day two, and that's the reason why I feel fine or feel good at least for that, and I think we'd agree with the staff recommendation extending the scope of that.
Darryl?
A couple of things, and I think this is in some ways repeating what others have said, but for me, the original proposal was confined to circumstances where we knew the information existed at a individual contract level. And that's because the way that we had defined that original proposal was that it, the individual contract level and the group had exactly the same outcome in terms of the proportionality, if you like, of the process that came back. And it meant that we could apply methodology that we knew in that circumstance was non-arbitrary. I think then, as we've gone around doing the outreach, I've been persuaded that there are a number of contracts where you can have an equivalent amount of certainty in knowing what the likely outcome is, but they would have been excluded simply because of how narrowly we defined proportionate. And so that led me to the conclusion that the only way we could then take that next step is by going the route of looking at expectations rather than actual contractual terms, specific contractual terms. You needed to look at what you expected was going to happen. And I think that comes to my answer anyway, Nick, to your question, is that once I had moved in my own mind from contractual term, specified contractual term of recovery, to expected, I just couldn't see any reason why you wouldn't then go for the whole thing. So it wasn't even that you couldn't really draw the line. It just made sense that you had now changed the term and therefore you could move on. I think it's worth saying, though, that there's an extra step in this, and I think one of the concerns we had when we were looking at this in the first round was this idea of the arbitrariness. What I think is important in thinking about the proposal to expand the scope is also the consideration of the methodology that we're putting in, because we're putting in a fairly, or you're proposing a fairly distinct methodology that removes any other potential way that you might go about doing it, and hence removes that concern about arbitrariness. And I think the second part that's important is, I think when we were considering solutions in the first round, almost any solution we were thinking about at that stage potentially would have required additional information. this solution, and I think in fairness it was proposed to us in comment letters, so it's not something we came up necessarily entirely ourselves with, but came through the comment letter process. And what it does is it uses, as we've said, existing info that's available, and it uses it in a way that eliminates the absolute arbitrariness. There's now a mechanism that you apply to each contract that comes up with reinsurance. So I think it's that basis that probably leads me to feel comfortable with expanding the scope.
It's a goody two-shoes comment, but it follows up on Daryl's comment about how we learned this from the comment, you know, a lot of the genesis for the thinking in this area in the comment letters. It just, to me, is validating something we don't even question, which is the amount of information and value we get back from comment letters, especially when people take the time to understand what our objectives and concerns were, and when they have concerns about operationality, coming back with suggestions about how we could address it in a way that isn't just put in another exception, but links back to, you know, thinking about some of the basics of the model. So I think this is an area where we learned a lot. You know, it really changed our thinking in this area from the comment letters. So that's what I mean by goody two-shoes comment. But
good comment. We do listen. All right.
Okay, move on to the second bit.
Huh? We're going to take the vote to the end.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I'm going to
vote to the
end.
Okay, so we'll move on to the second part of the paper. The second section is in paragraphs 21 to 23 and is about the proposed calculation for determining the loss recovery amount on the reinsurance contract that would be recognised at the same time as the loss on the underlying insurance contract. Some respondents, in particular some national standard setters and regulators, expressed the concern that the amendment would be open to abuse. They noted that the proposed calculation considers the amount of claims the insurer would recover from the reinsurer, but does not consider the premium the insurer will pay to the reinsurer for that service. The analysis in the paper uses examples to demonstrate why the staff think the proposal provides useful information about losses and loss recoveries, both when reinsurance premiums are higher than and also lower than the expected claim recoveries. Those examples are set out in the appendix, and they're also summarised in the main body of the paper in paragraphs 48 to 50. And the staff are recommending the board finalise the proposed calculation, amended as a consequence of the recommended extension of the scope. So I will now hand over to the board to discuss the analysis on the loss recovery calculation.
Sue?
Excuse me, building on Mary's goody two-shoe comment, I agree with the recommendation here in terms of how the calculation works, and I was going to give the industry a compliment because I was struck particularly when I was in Australia at the TRG meeting in Australia, where they talked about this in quite a lot of detail, with the sort of willingness of the industry to try and look at what we'd proposed and to build as much as possible on the mechanics and the ideas that we'd used to facilitate the re-deliberation process. And I thought that was a particularly constructive example of a reaction to a proposal of ours, so I wanted to thank the industry for that. I think what's really important, though, for me, and it was something I emphasised when I was talking to them about it, was I'd like us to sort of reiterate in what we write that my sort of working assumption is that these assumptions that they'll use to do these calculations would be building on sort of expectations and cash flow analysis that they're already doing to apply IFRS 17. So there should be consistency between the thinking that's going on for these calculations and what's going on elsewhere, because I think that provides at least a certain level of discipline around quite a subjective area. But it is really, for me, an extension of everything else you're doing in 17, because it's all based on expectations. But I agree with the extension of the calculation the way that it's been suggested.
Laura, I think I agree. I just wanted to clarify something just in terms of making sure I've understood what the proposal is. So the way I've understood this is the starting point of doing the calculation is to start with the reinsurance contract or the group of reinsurance contracts and to sort of essentially flow it downhill to look at what the underlying contracts are of that reinsurance contract. If I have a look at the staff recommendation, though, 2B1, we refer there to the loss recognised on the group, singular, of the underlying insurance contracts. Now, when I think about a reinsurance contract, I'm assuming that typically it will be multiple groups that it covers. Sometimes it may be a single group. Sometimes it may even be a subgroup. Now, I assume that when we think about what the underlying contracts are, it's whatever is set by the reinsurance contract. Am I understanding that?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. So we have used the word group underlying insurance contracts in B, and I think there we just had an assumption in our minds that we were talking about just one group of underlying insurance contracts. But actually what the amendment would be doing would be taking the reinsurance contract and every underlying insurance contract it covers to work out the expected recovery percentage. Actually, I think that's probably better explained rather than in paragraph 2B, but there's paragraph 20, which probably sets that out slightly clearer. So the use of the word group in paragraph 2 is probably a bit of an oversight there.
Question 3?
Question 3, yeah. Okay, so the last part of the paper is in paragraphs 59 to 64. And that includes analysis on other aspects of the proposal that a small number of respondents commented on. In those paragraphs, the staff recommend the board confirm the amendment would apply only if the reinsurance contract is entered into before or at the same time as the underlying insurance contract. Not to add the proposed footnote to the basis for conclusions. And to clarify that the existing subsequent measurement requirement that is already in IFRS 17 that Martin mentioned earlier would apply also when the entity applies the premium allocation approach. Okay, so I'd ask the board for any comments on that analysis.
Chen Chao.
I agree with all the staff's proposal. I think remove the footnotes because the basis of the footnotes does not exist, so it's fine. About to clarify of the timing of the entering into the reinsurance contract is very necessary, because if we allow those reinsurance contracts held, you know, after the loss of the underlying contract you recognize, it will cause some abuse of the proposal amendment. So I agree. With regard to guidance on the loss recovery component of those reinsurance contracts, I think it's very necessary because proposed amendment will apply all the, you know, reinsurance contracts. So attract those loss recovery components is very necessary. I understand that staff will consider, you know, to provide some guidance.
I get that.
Either, you know, to extend the illustrative example in the, you know, the example, or whether provide education material. From my personal view, I think it's better to extend the illustrative example rather than provide education material. So it will be very helpful for the preparers. So just from this point of view, I would like to, you know, prefer to clarify those loss recovery components guidance to be included in illustrated example rather providing education material.
Any further comments? No, okay. So should we take the votes then?
Yep. Take the vote on all three questions.
Okay.
Can we vote in
one go? Do you
want them separate?
Let's try if we can vote on all three questions at once.
Okay.
I sense a lot of consensus around the table.
Okay, so that's 14.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.